I found through many years of bitter experience that book reviewers all across the country and in England, especially in England, because in England they have the tradition of reviewing books in groups and do 7, 8, 10, 15 at one time. Book reviewers, I would say, at least 40% of the time, don't read the book. Now, this sounds like an extravagant claim, but when you get back reviews, and I recently got a review, now you've read that book, a review in which someone claimed that Peter Lake was a character who was distinguished because he could fly. And then he flies from place to place, they said, and he can jump tall buildings and do this and that as if he were Superman. I have, for this book, the Baymen were supposedly the ones who interred their dead in the crypt underneath the Hudson, and the Baymen chased Peter Lake and killed him. And sometimes you get the main character with the wrong name, or a completely different character who's inserted that you've never heard of, who doesn't exist in the book, but they remember it from skimming another book that they also skimmed. And it's very common that book reviewers, because of the pressure that they're under, because they work just like everyone else, and they have X number of books to do in a week, especially in England, simply don't read the book. They read the flap copy, and they skim through it. Now,
incidentally, you can get away with that to a much greater degree if
non-fiction.
It's a non-fiction book.
Yeah, non-fiction.
You can catch things very rapidly. And
that's right.
With fiction, it's much more difficult because, one, you have to get the idea, the tone, and you have to try to understand the author's voice. And it's so you have to. That's why it's much more difficult for many fiction writers to get an audience, a mass audience, outside of their own work, unless there is something unusual about them, or different, or newsworthy in the way that we mentioned Vidal or Capote. Those people, somebody who is a craftsman who sits here and works but is not particularly newsworthy himself, it's sometimes more difficult for him to sell his book and to explain what he's doing because he's not getting the forum.
Well, there are many ramifications of what you just said. I'd like to say, just to continue what I was saying and then get to what you said for a second, it's more important than just hearing the voice or reading it relatively carefully. Because, for instance, with this book, I spent 5 years writing this book. I spent most of that time in writing this book. I think all day long. I read and think very carefully about a lot of things. And the book is very carefully constructed, very carefully constructed, so that there's more packed into it than it might seem from reading it, because it goes fast, or it is said anyway that it goes fast. I can't make that claim, but there's a lot more weight in there. I hope, I assume, than one would think. And if you skim a book, then you can't get any of it. And the conclusions that many reviewers, now mind you, I'm talking now even about the ecstatic reviews and the wonderful reviews. I don't mean to look gift horses in the mouth, but even the really wonderful reviews frequently, most of the time, had no idea what was going on in the book. You know, they approach it 2 degrees. But in terms of what you're saying about newsworthiness and being a sort of a magnet for attracting attention and then selling your book, especially in the age of television or whatever, it reminds me of Melville. You know what happened to Melville? Herman Melville. Yeah. He started out at about age 25, and he wrote two books, called Typee and the other called Omu, or Umo. I forgot which, but O's and M's and O's, with the M's in the middle. And these were about, it was a chronicle of his voyage on a whaling ship and then escape and being chased around South Sea Islands by Indians, largely made up, some of it true. And it was smash all across the country, and everyone thought, who is this young rake, Herman Melville, who was chased around the South Sea Islands, very exotic. It was like popular fiction today, it was like thrillers. And then he wrote a book called White Jacket, he wrote a book called Redburn, and then White Jacket, or maybe White Jacket and then Redburn, about it was a sensationalist book in a way, well done but sensationalist, about flogging in the Navy. At that time in the U.S. Navy, they used to flog sailors. And a copy was put on every senator's and congressman's desk. In those days, they had fewer congressmen, so they could afford to do this. Created a big sensation. And Melville was heading along, and then he wrote Moby Dick. And Moby Dick, big fat thing as it was considered to be utterly incomprehensible. Someone said, I defy anyone to show me a single idea in it. It was supposed to be light and frothy, etc., etc., and just a nothing book. Didn't sell. It was hardly even reviewed. And Melville died in obscurity. I mean, really in obscurity. Most people thought he was dead already. And he was half mad, anyway, if not entirely mad, and very, very miserable. No one ever paid him any attention. And he would have gone completely unrecognized had it not been for the discovery in the 20s by, I believe, Eliot and other people. So this business of newsworthiness is sort of like an accident of God. I mean, if you have it and you have something to say, then that's wonderful. But if you have something to say and you don't have it, well, then you may be in trouble. I like to think that the truth will out eventually, but I'm not sure that that's necessarily so. And obviously, there are a lot of there must be a lot of Emily Dickinsons who no one's ever heard of, and a lot of Melvilles who didn't make it. But in terms of being newsworthy, that's something which the world is imperfect. This is one of the conditions that you must meet, and I don't think it's that bad. Rather than sitting around and complaining about it, I'd rather try to be newsworthy. Just like when literary people get together, they often consort, and the notion arises among them, which they all support, that they're somehow superior to, well, of course, it's superior to everyone, but superior to, especially to business. I was once at a literary prize thing down south, and we were driving along in the car, and someone made some crack about middle management. They said, you know, degrading middle management. And I was sitting, my wife was in the car with me, and she works at the Chase Manhattan Bank, and she's a vice president, but then she was a second vice president, so she was middle management. In fact, even now she's upper middle management. And I didn't take that very kindly, but more important than that, it represents an attitude. The attitude is that writers and literary people are superior to business. That's on the one hand, and on the other hand, they'll say how done over they are by business, how manipulated they are, and how the big corporations and the publishing companies and the publishing conglomerates wring them out and take all their fat, and how there's so much injustice and they're so powerless, etc. Well, how can you be superior to something which has complete control of you? How can you be superior to something which has power over you, which is ruining your life, etc., etc.? You may not like it. You're not superior to it.
Well, they're talking about intellectual or artistic superiority, not in terms of pure power.
But being intelligent, which I take it is a component of intellectualism, although it probably isn't in a lot of America, but being intelligent, I think, means also being able to stay on your feet and to manipulate when manipulation is called for, to protect yourself, to gain power when power is necessary to preserve what you're doing.
Well, it doesn't work that way. It doesn't work that way because, in terms of a writer, for example, his focus is on things other than power, in general terms. So he is playing in the wrong ballpark, so to speak. So it's obvious that if these people complain about the power, the manipulation of the business establishment, the people complaining about it don't know how to play those rules,
right,
with those rules, or how to confront those people head on.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
That doesn't negate their own intellectual superiority in other ways.
But here's
I'm not defending either side.
I'm attacking one side. Here's my response to that. Let's assume that business publishing, the way the world works in hard terms, economics or whatever, even publicity, as ugly as it is, we'll bring it in. Let's assume that that's a system. It is a system. It's a conglomeration of systems. You can rise to the top if you master the system. What is the mechanics of writing? I mean, just learning how to write, not style or anything, just using a pen to write, to form letters, or learning how to type, or, and then learning the rules of grammar, all that, that's a system. Why is it that it's legitimate to learn one system and not the other? I think that what happens is that these people stop learning. They stop learning when they're in college, maybe, or even in high school. And they're not willing to realize that you have to master various systems in order to preserve your, and here I've used quotation marks, your art. You see? They know that to speak beautifully and to be and to put their art down, they have to know how to write, they have to know how to type, they have to know how to edit, they have to know the rules of grammar, etc., etc. Why can't you just extend that to learning how to survive in a world which is one, a conglomeration of market forces, and two, one in which people are playing against one another, instead of just retreating and saying, oh, it's so terrible and so ugly and I'm so far above it. Anyway, all this is my way of saying that that's what I do. So,
back to the newsworthiness for a minute. Before we're really going to run out of time, so I want to ask you some questions about yourself and before we get to the book. But just throw out something. Mention the reviewers who don't read, and tying that in with the newsworthiness of a writer. Styron is frequently newsworthy because he adopts causes.
Mm-hmm.
Signs petitions and things like that, marches and peace marches, and things like mm-hmm. that. But I noticed when Judson Hahn, who was the former literary critic for the Daily News, reviewed Sophie's Choice, gave him a big spread, too. Right at the top, Judson had titled the book Sophie's Way in the Daily News, still the largest circulation tabloid in the country. Sophie's Way. I just remembered that because I was going through a whole bunch of clippings trying to get my files in order, and there it was, Judge in Hand, Sophie's Way.
Oh.
Now, if somebody misinterprets what's in a book, what about blowing the title?
Oh, I have never had a book where the title hasn't been, I would say, 20-25% of the cases. The Winter's Tale here is frequently called A Winter's Tale. Even my agents... I won't say which agency it is because I have several agents. My agents, in a contract, corrected someone who had written Winter's Tale and said the correct title is A Winter's Tale. It's just plain Winter's Tale. My first book, A Dove of the East and Other Stories, was always The Dove of the East. One reviewer wrote it and said, I don't know what prompted them to do this, Peace in the East. Refiner's Fire was included in a group review of petroleum geology books. I mean, I have stories like this that could go on forever. They frequently mess up even the titles. You said something about causes. I too am political, not in the same way as most other writers. I get involved in various causes.
Oh.
And
brilliant.
but I think
this is
Sunday. Yeah. I think that there should be an ironclad wall of separation between politics and literature. I think that when writers use their position as writers to trumpet their political views, it's an abuse. And I have run on a separate track politically because I'm a citizen in a democracy and I have political views. But I keep it completely isolated from my work. And for instance, in literary gatherings or when I give readings, et cetera, I never talk about politics. Unless someone asks me a question or challenges me or something, then I'll answer the question. But I deliberately stay away from it. I will talk about politics in political functions if I'm asked to do so for specifically. But I don't think that the two should be mixed.
Well, let me ask you a couple of things. Let's just go back a little bit because you probably have things to do and places to go. And I have a lot of material to distill. I'd like to find out a little bit about you. Are you a New Yorker?
Yeah, I was born on 86th Street and York Avenue. I've never said that, actually, in my life. It's the first time I've ever said that. I always say I was born here, or I was born in Manhattan. I never gave the address, but that's where I was born.
What year was that?
1947.
Mount Sinai Hospital?
No, Doctor's Hospital. So,
Mount Sinai, just a guess, a Big East Side hospital.
Mount Sinai is on Fifth Avenue and 100th Street, 102nd, 103rd. This is Doctor's Hospital. It's right near Gracie Mansion. It's a private hospital.
Education?
Yes. you don't mean back in high school?
No, just give me an idea. I little bit.
A little school called Scarborough, which was in Scarborough on Hudson, up the river, where we moved when I was about five. Then I went to Harvard as an undergraduate, and I went to Harvard Graduate School of Arts and Sciences in political science, and I went at various times to... and then I went to Oxford. I studied history under Hugh Trevor Roper, who you may recall. He's the man who said, "I stake my reputation on the fact that the Hitler diaries are genuine," which is very unfortunate because he's a brilliant man, and he should have a wonderful reputation, but he made a bad slip, which, from which he may not ever recover in the public mind. But he's a wonderful man and a brilliant man. I studied history there under him, and then Columbia for political science. So I have a lot of academic experience.
Obviously, you have an academic background in politics. Had this been a goal, to find yourself in some form of politics rather than writing, at least one point in your life?
No, it is in that it's a sort of it's my... Everyone has two hands, and this is what I do with my left hand. But I never intended that in the beginning. My intent was always to study it because I was interested in it, purely. And now that may seem like a very gentlemanly thing to do. In other words, to approach something and study it purely out of passion for it or interest, with no intent to making a living from it. But it was not because I was phenomenally wealthy or could do without making a living. During this time, I worked as a dishwasher and a surveyor and a Pinkerton and did various things and lived on various tiny budgets, so that I don't feel as if I were simply a dilettante. I was not a dilettante. I was doing it for the love of it, but I never intended to make a living from it. I never intended to teach, and I never intended to get a job in a government bureaucracy, and I never even intended to write, really, about it, although occasionally now I do, and I probably will more in the future, but the intent, anyway, was not one of... I always used to say in my applications to these various schools, the Talmud says, do not use the Talmud as a spade to dig in the ground. In other words, don't use it to make a living, just study it out of your love for it. And that's what I did. I was always interested in political science and economics, military history, things like that.
Going back to your childhood, were there any indications that you would be a writer? Did you do it? Did you publish your own newspaper, for example? Did you write your own poetry, your own stories?
I was always the editor of the literary magazine and such, and I always was good with words. But what happened really was, when I was 17 years old, I went to France, and I wanted to impress a girl in the south of France, so I rented a motorcycle, which I had never learned how to drive, and I did all right for the first couple hours. And when I was leaving her to go home to Marseille, I had a crash on the motorcycle, a really bad crash, and got smashed up. And then I went to Switzerland. I was a very odd adolescent. I figured that in the 19th century, of which I had been reading about up to my ears, all the characters in novels went to Switzerland to recuperate. So I went to Switzerland to recuperate. But that didn't work because it was too cold and too expensive and too rainy. So I found myself in Paris in a hotel named the Hotel Garony. I went to this hotel and I said to the innkeeper, give me a room, please. And he showed me to a room where I said, I can't take this room because it smells of burning rubber. It's horrible. I said, what'd you do, burn tires in here or something? He said, no. He said, I don't smell anything. So I'll give you another room. He took me up another flight. He said, how about this room? I said, no, it smells of burning. And every room he took me to smelled of burning rubber. And he said, well, there's no, I smell nothing. He said, these are the rooms we have. And I said, all right, I'll take it. And I took the room. I couldn't get over how much it smelled like burning rubber. It was terrible. And then I began to get a terrible, terrible headache. Really the worst headache that you can possibly imagine. And I just lay in bed for a couple of days in tremendous pain. I didn't know what was happening to me. It was such that it incapacitated me to the point where I didn't even think to go to a doctor. It was August in Paris anyway. There were no doctors. There were no anything. And one night, 4 o'clock in the morning, suddenly I got up. There was no pain. Nothing. I mean, I was, for the first time in days, I had absolutely no pain. And the difference was so phenomenal that I felt as if I could just float out of bed. So I floated out of bed, and I turned on the light, and I remember it washed across a white blotter. It was just brilliant white. It was lovely to see because there was no pain. And I sat down, and I took a piece of paper, because there was a piece of paper there and a pen, and I began to write. And I had a great time. It was something unlike anything I'd ever done. And I was sort of satisfied. I put the stuff down, turned off the light, went to sleep, had a good sleep, woke up the next morning and looked at what I had written, in hardly remembering it, but realizing that something had happened. And it was a paragraph which was a description of Hagia Santa Sophia in Istanbul. I'd never seen it. I didn't know anything about it or anything. It was beautifully written for a 17-year-old. It's just way beyond what I should be able to do. It's wonderful, and I had such a good time doing it. That was it. That's how I began to. I never stopped from that point on. I thought that it was just terrific fun. It gave me the greatest satisfaction of anything I can possibly think of. I get completely absorbed in doing it. I did, you know, then and have from then on, and it was just entirely a wonderful thing to do. So I did it.
How did Dove of the East come about?
Well, that's a result of just writing stories. The first story in there, by the way, that's a book which was published by Knopf in 1975, largely from stories that were in the New Yorker. And the one of the stories in there I wrote a year and a half after this business in the hotel. I mean, these were, Dove of the East has some stories that I wrote in college. A good many of them, in fact, and most of them were only done only a few years after I graduated as an undergraduate. And I published stories in the New Yorker, and then I hawked them around to different publishers in collected form, and finally Knopf took them, and they published them. So,
I certainly hope your career has taken off in terms of full-time employment. But
indeed it has.
Yes, but in most instances, writing is not enough to sustain a writer. My colleague, Paul Jeffers, for example, my immediate superior, has managed to publish some 12 different books, but could never conceivably be able to quit his honest job and to go into write. Have you ever been faced with the problem of finding other employment while you write?
Oh, sure. When I was writing The Dove of the East and Refiner's Fire. This is when I did things like being a Pinkerton or I was a dishwasher in the Liberty Mutual cafeteria for a short time and in other cafeterias. As a surveyor, I unloaded freight cars and stuff and worked on labor exchanges, did freelance editing. You know, very often, I took a course in Irish literature at Harvard when I was an undergraduate with Professor Kelleher. And everyone he spoke about, Liam O'Flaherty and Sean O'Faline and all these Irish short story writers, he'd always preface their biographies by saying, O'Brien, who is a made-up name, worked as a merchant seaman from 1900, and then he worked as a logger in the Canadian woods, and then he did this and then did that. And my life has been the same in that sense. I do a lot of things for a relatively short time. I was in the British Merchant Navy, for example, but just for a month.
A month?
A month, yeah. It's mainly to work for Passage. I was on a Collier doing the Atlantic run. I was in the Israeli Army and Air Force. That was longer, but I didn't do it for the money. God knows, combat pay was $12 a month in 1972. You get an extra $2 for being in a combat zone. You get $10 a month, normally $12 combat. But I did all these things, and I was not able to support myself, but somehow I never had any doubts that I would be able to. I was never worried about them. Of course, I have a possibility of an alternate career because I have this political academic thing. But nonetheless, I never had any doubts about it. And it's panned out. I can make a living from it.
Isn't it interesting that so many fine writers have come out of Harvard? Probably if you were to take any one school, or if you were to look at any group of writers today, I would say the majority of successful writers, I can't say majority, but
no,
so many.
I
can't say that.
What do you mean, who?
I'm trying to find a better way to phrase
who?
That. But I mean, it's...
Apart from Updike.
Well, but I have so many. I wish I could... I can't even tell you. But I must... Sometimes I get one or two a week from Harvard. Some write nonfiction and some write fiction.
Mm-hmm.
But I do. I get a tremendous amount of people. It seems to me that Harvard is so strong educationally that it would almost be bound to turn out people.
Well, Harvard, yeah, Harvard is.
With a literary bent.
T.S. Eliot, and I don't know, he didn't go there as an undergraduate, or maybe he did go there as an undergraduate, but Robert Frost, who didn't go there as an undergraduate, but who had an association with it, and God knows a lot of people like that. You can even include Norman Mailer. But the fact is that the secret of Harvard in that sense is that Harvard, because of its position, because of its reputation, its name, its endowment, the fact that it's ahead in many things, is able to skim the top off the graduating classes in the high schools in the country. And they're very good at choosing people who later will become president or cabinet member of some sort, or important in whatever field they choose to do. So that it's not as if they make them. I imagine that having been to a bunch of universities, not as an undergraduate, only at Harvard, but having been a graduate student or taught briefly at a lot of universities, I have a feeling that the Harvard education is really not that much different from any other good or decent university. It's not as if they have a trick of making people. It's just that they draw the I wouldn't say even the best people, but they draw them those people who have succeeded early and who have a chance of succeeding later.
Looks very good on the resume.
Yeah, it looks good on the resume, although, as I said, I've never used it for anything.
Let's talk a little bit about the tone of Winter's Tale. It's obvious you have strong feelings about New York City, isn't it?
Oh, yes, I love New York. It's funny. I'm talking about the accuracy and perceptiveness of book reviewers. When I was writing that, I lived on 95th Street, which at that time was lined with SRO hotels. And there were every night incidents with the police. There were frequently shootings, lunatics jumping up and down, screaming all night, and bottles breaking. It was very urban, to say the least. And in 77, when we had that fire, the whole neighborhood was gutted and burnt, and there were people running around the street carrying big things of furniture on their head, etc. It was a very urban neighborhood. This was across town from where I was born, and I was writing Winter's Tale, which many people have taken to be I always get this word wrong, a paean. Maybe that's the word. I don't know. If it's not, please block it out. To the city. It's a hymn to the city. And someone reviewed Refiner's Fire in the New York Review of Books. And there's a character in Refiner's Fire who's an Irish mercenary from Northern Ireland. His name is Farrell. And he says, at one point, he's a lunatic, and he says, "I hate cities," he says. I'd like to take everyone who lives in a city and crush his head. And he said, "They're soft, they're disgusting, I hate them." And he hates cities. Because he thinks that people who live in cities are soft and decadent, and he's tough and solid steel muscle, etc. And New York Review of Books said, quoted him and said, Halperin hates cities. He only likes the country. He's part of this new movement. See, they see everything in terms of movements or everything really in terms of politics. It was a political frisk. He's part of this new movement of back to the country, this sort of reactionary nonsense about detesting cities because blacks live in cities and you know, it's all racism or whatever. And this was true lunacy. It was a character in the book. I was in the midst of writing a 700-page book in praise of the idea of a city, and they came out with their review, which doted on the fact. I mean, which concentrated on the fact, supposedly, that I hated cities. So there, that fits in with the other part. But yes, I how can you not love New York? I mean, you have to hate it too. But it's
well, you managed to wipe it out at the end.
Oh, but then the whole point is, it's part of the point is anyway, is that it begins rebuilding the day after.
Part of its rebirth.
Yeah, it's a well, there's continual rebirth in the city. That's what one thing which is so nice about it. Building goes down, building goes up, right on the same spot. It's the most vital city in the world. In fact, there's a part which I cut out before I even submit it to the publisher, simply because I was in the process of editing or trimming it, in which a character who is there's a character who's debating with an Englishman, and the Englishman who lives in America and works here and has voted with his feet to come here and live in New York is nonetheless very snobby, the way the English frequently are about American culture and American intelligence, let's put it that way. They can be very terrible about that. I remember once I was walking in front of the American Cultural Center in front of an American embassy, and there were two Englishmen walking in front of me, and one said, and they looked at the sign and said, American Cultural Center, and the other one, they looked at each other with amazement, and one said, I can't believe that. How dare they put that? They don't have a culture. It's such terrible snobs. I went to when I was at Oxford once, I went to the bookstore there called Blackwell's, great, magnificent bookstore. They have a separate store just for art books. And I said, where's the American painting section? And the clerk looked at me and he said, and they had about 8 million art books. He said, is there American painting? And they didn't have American painting section. Not only section, they didn't even have any books on American.
Well, Theroux got even with them. Did you read his new book,
no,
Kingdom
no.
by the Sea? He addresses this identical topic. And he says that the British characterization of Americans is not accurate, not true, is wrong, but that the British themselves are indeed a cultural failure, and he has turned their snobbery against them. So, but you can also see that much of the British much of what the British enjoy watching, say, on television comes from America. This is some of the lowest material we have. I noticed Dean Martin, for example, who's a comedian or singer I happen to detest, but he is adored in England. And I saw on cable television recently, here he comes out with a bottle of feigning drunkenness and smoking a cigarette as he's singing. He can barely sing, and they love it.
Oh, they of course, you know, France loves Jerry Lewis. So does Denmark. Very popular. But on a more positive note, rather than continuing to attack the English, who, after all, are attacked on enough fronts, the character in my book, who hit the cutting room floor, says to the Englishman, after the Englishman is deriding New York City, he says, look, whether it's good or not, whether you like it or not, whether it's the best thing or not, doesn't matter. But as it happens, New York is the place where Western civilization is presently working itself out. As imperfect as it is, as ugly as it often is, as terrible, brutal, and violent as it often is, I think that right now this is the junction of many different currents in history. And although it will probably pass, maybe soon to Tokyo or Peking or who knows where, but as...
It won't.
Not for a while.
No, I don't think it ever will. And
well,
unless something
eventually.
Major happens.
Oh, no, it will. It will eventually.
Well, these other cities are too homogeneous. That's the correct word. The people are too much alike there. for them to have the clash of cultures trying to work these things out. So you're just not going to find that unless something major happens, unless Tokyo becomes a home for the United Nations or something of that nature, unless there's a tremendous immigration there, and I don't see that at all.
Well, you know, in the Renaissance, you had the Italian city-states were the sort of the leading cities of the world, and then in the 18th century it was Paris, and in the 19th century it was Paris in the 18th century, and then towards the end Vienna, 19th century Vienna. And in London. London became the premier city of the world. And then in the 20th century, London and Paris faded into the background, and New York took over the mantle. There are a lot of cities in the world which are not so homogenous. For instance, it's possible that maybe, given a change in currents of development, that Sao Paulo in Brazil, which has tremendous numbers of Japanese and Chinese immigrants, and of course Brazilians of all shades and hues, and Spanish speaking, Portuguese speaking, Sao Paulo is one hell of a city. It's nothing like New York yet, but you never know. 50 years, 100 years, these things can happen in various cities. I doubt if it will ever march backward. I don't think it'll this whatever it is will take up residence in London again, or in Paris, or in Vienna, or in Rome.
Mark Helfrin, we've got to get back on track.
Okay.
We're running out of time. Winter, snow, and even in refiners, fire, you address yourself to winter and snow as Michael Pearl?
Marshall
Pearl is, as his foster parents or adopted parents up along the river. And so some of those winter, cold, snowy, and yet warm feelings are there, but obviously are vastly manifested in Winter's Tale. Tell me about your feelings with regard to winter and snow.
Well, it's not so much winter and snow, and everyone asks me this. They say, how is it, why is it that the season has such a strong presence in the book? And a lot of people feel as if they can, when they read the book, it's as if they're looking into one of those glass balls with snow in it, you know, and drawn into it, as if they're looking into one of those Easter eggs. It's not so much winter, because I can do the same thing with summer, spring, fall. It's simply that I've always thought that the portrayal of nature is a legitimate subject unto itself. If you notice, it's the British tradition to start a chapter with a descriptive paragraph, and they'll wax eloquent. The sun was setting, and in blood red, etc. And then they stop, and you read nothing of nature. There's no sense of climate or light or temperature, whatever. I don't think that's not my way to do it anyway. I've always thought that nature in itself is a legitimate character, perhaps the most legitimate character. When I was in college, I ran into trouble with my tutor, William Alfred. You may have heard of him. He wrote a play called Hogan's Goat with Faye Dunaway. It was a very successful play. We had a big debate because I wrote a novel in which there were no people. It took place in the, it was a novella really, it took place in the Galapagos. And there wasn't a single person in the whole thing, and it wasn't a question of personifying an animal either and making it a fable, because the animals were not personified; they were animals. This may be maybe the only novel like this ever written. I don't know. He said it didn't make it because there were no people. He said, you've got to have people. You've got to have feelings, and I agree. Certainly, you do. But the point is that I see enough in nature, and just in terrain. In the weather to write about. I enjoy tremendously just going outside and watching the weather. And of course, winter, especially around here, is severe enough and dark enough, and it has so many associations tied into it. And the snow is such a wonderful thing. And the ice, and when the river ice is over, and when the moon comes up upstate where I live, and you see it over 50 miles of snow-covered fields, There's so much there. Just coming into a fire, to a house in which there's a wood fire burning. There's so much in terms of the thing itself that I don't use it just as atmosphere. I use it and not as a character either, but as something, let's say, more than atmosphere and as important as a character.
As an instrument.
Yeah. Yeah.
I was very amused by your characterizations of the two competing newspapers, The Ghost and The Sun. You obviously gave that a lot of thought, the idea of the old tabloids worked. Tell me a little bit about what your mind as you develop the character of the newspapers.
Well, I had a lot more about them, but I cut them out, partly at the publisher's urging and partly just because it was going on too long. And after I cut them out, of course, everywhere I go all around the country, people say, oh, why did you put more in about Craig Binky? But perhaps it's better for them to say, why wasn't there more, than to have said it was a little bit too much, leave them a little hungry. But these newspapers are polar, just like many other things in the book. And I don't mean polar in terms of winter or cold, but polar in that they are opposite ends of the spectrum in terms of integrity and intellectual depth. On the one hand, you have The Sun, which is much like the New York Times or the Times of London or a German. You know, it's like a German newspaper. German newspapers are extraordinary. One of my greatest disappointments is that my German is not good enough to enable me to read the German newspapers. They are so serious and so the quality is so high that it makes any American paper look silly. Most German, maybe the top five German newspapers. It's like reading a scholarly study. But anyway, that's The Sun, and then the Ghost is something modeled on things like the New York Post or other Rupert Murdoch papers, in that it's totally insane and totally without integrity and totally sensationalist and also rather funny in being so. For instance, The Ghost, the editors of The Ghost realized as they were putting together their paper that they didn't have to follow up headlines with stories because nobody cared. The point was to write a headline which would get people to look at the paper and buy it and read it on the subway. So they have frequently had headlines in it which had no connection whatsoever to anything inside, such as Dead Model Sues Racehorse. And then there was no story because nobody did any such thing.
It's almost like this is a fantasy. It's a fairy tale. It's a wonderful thing. What sort of influences did you have?
I have to say something about when you say fantasy, and that is, I say this all the time.
Uh-oh.
Fantasy in America means something particular. It means shopping mall gothic. It means little dwarves with red hats and magic swords and shining horseshoes and stuff like that. I don't consider, of course I may be wrong, but I don't consider that this is anything like that. In fact, I don't like that genre at all. I don't read that, and it doesn't please me. So if anyone has the misapprehension that Winter's Tale is going to be like The Lord of the Rings, they should not bother buying it, because it's not like that. However, it is not realistic. It follows a different convention. What convention does it follow? It follows the convention of literature, which was prevalent up until the Enlightenment. And in fact, through the what we have in the 19th century is a struggle between the ancient conventions of literature and modernism as a result of the Enlightenment, in which the Enlightenment won, and the modern novel, the modern short story, is ultimately realistic. In this, as in the models that I used, which was your question, the laws of physics are abridged at will. Not too much, but they are abridged. Nonetheless, it's not fantasy. Now, for instance, you would not call the Bible, in which there are pillars of fire and all kinds of things that happen which have nothing to do with reality as we know it, fantasy.
Who wouldn't?
Well, no, it's not fantasy.
Of course the Bible's a fantasy. By anybody's stretch of the imagination.
No. Wait. Would you call the Divine Comedy a fantasy? Or the Tempest? Or the Aeneid? Or the Odyssey? they're not fantasies. There's a difference between that and, let's say, Tolkien or science fiction fantasy. Or
listen to the Parting the Red Sea. I mean, all of the old fables that you find within the Bible, I mean, they are fantastic by anyone's point of view.
They're fantastic, but they're not. But they're not fantasy. There's a difference.
Not fantasy in the genre that you.
Right. That's all I mean. The fact is that this is the tradition in literature: the Divine Comedy, the Aeneid, the Odyssey, the Iliad, the Tempest, the Bible, you name it, which has been for thousands of years since the beginning of human existence. That's the way primitive literature is. It's the way tales are told. It's folk literature, etc., etc., in which part of the virtue and part of the advantages of being able to tell a story are that you can abridge the laws of physics. It doesn't have to be down to earth all the time. You can take flights of fancy. I don't think it's a fantasy, or at least not in the modern American sense of what we think, you know, the trolls with their red hats and Dungeons and Dragons type stuff.
About 3-4 weeks ago, I had a lengthy interview with Raymond Carver, who could not be similar to you if he, even if he were to try. I don't think he could be similar to you. Your writing style is extremely poetic and descriptive, and Carver is not. I guess that's the best way to explain Carver. Tell me a little bit about how you approach your writing style.
Well, I think it's very simple. I stick my neck out all the time. I mean, I really stick my neck out, and a lot of people take the opportunity and try to cut off my head. But I take chances in that I have never been afraid to make metaphors, and I always do. So that I don't write in the Hemingway-esque style of keeping everything clean and unencumbered and without ornament. I try to make it not ornamental. Because when you say something is ornamental, what you really mean is that there's stuff sticking out from it. But I try to make the language as rich as possible, to use it in an emotive sense, and to be direct about that. After all, this is the tradition in literature until really the 19th century. To the end of the 19th century, the beginning of the 20th century. The 20th century, which has brought us the Holocaust and nuclear weapons and wars which have killed more people than at any other time, and mechanization, alienation, etc., etc. The literature of the 20th century is minimalist literature. I don't like it.
You said that the work was extremely carefully constructed, and I can certainly see that. How did you go about the process of keeping track? If this covers 100 years, how many pages?
About 700.
700 pages covering 100 years. Myriad characters, some popping up years and years later after they first appear. How did you do this?
Well, you
couldn't do it just mentally, could you? Or did you have it so ingrained in your mind that you could?
Well, I did both. You see, I do two things. When I go to make a speech, I always have something written down, in case I freeze up, and as long as I have something written down, I never freeze up and I never look at it. I never have to look at it. I just make the speech or give the talk, and that's fine. The same thing applies to writing a book. I had about 200 pages of notes, including diagrams. Even everything's carefully plotted out and put down, and notes were recorded, characters logged in, names logged in, places. I had very well organized, systematically organized notes, but I never looked at them, because having made them, that was enough, and I was confident, and it all stuck in my head, primarily because I fell in love with the characters. I fell in love with the city that they were living in. I fell in love with what was happening to them, and you can't forget what you love. That's I mean, imagine if you had to fall in love with everything you wanted to try to remember. That would be very difficult. But look at the obverse of that, the converse. If you love something, you're not going to forget it.
Raquel Brennan, we've been speaking for an hour and 20 minutes.
And now you have
for a very small broadcast. And there are more things I would like to ask you, but in the interest of time, I can't. But I would like to say that the book, I was enthralled by the book. As I read it, I could sometimes feel fluttering of butterflies in my stomach because you communicated to me. And so I felt the book, and I enjoyed it, and I'm very, very glad that we had the chance to get together, and thank you very much for coming in.
Thank you. I had a good time, and it's a nice studio, and it was good to talk to you.
I wish I hate to cut this so short.